sometimes hospitals solving the problems of our country, but creating a better society, articulating connections between those in positions of government and those needing their rights. What about the code of law? Some healing novel the man mentioned. He actually became Chief Justice of South Africa on the 12th of October, the day I ceased to be a judge. He became Chief Justice. And he has a saying, it's in one of his judgments, so I'm not giving away anything. He says, in a constitutional state, the hands of justice are never tied. It's a wonderful phrase for me. You can't say, oh, it's terrible, the law's terrible. It's doing a great injustice, but I as a judge have got nothing to say. It's up to Parliament. You can't say that. If fundamental rights are infringed, the judges have got to find a way. Even if it's to tell Parliament you've got 1 year to make the change, you make it obligatory. And the other statement is one that I'm getting credit for. I actually got it from Martha Minow, who's a professor at Nadine Law School in Harvard. She got it from her dad, and I once went to thank her dad, but he said he got it from somebody who the author was, and he looked up in a dictionary of famous quotations, and they attributed it to him. So, and the statement is that the function of the law is to convert misfortune to be endured into injustice to be remedied. And looking back on my 15 years on the court, I like to feel that's exactly what we were doing. Thank you.
Lightning lecture. I just had a question, and you spoke about accountability. For example, in the ARV case about the anti-retrovirals to pregnant women, the initial argument of the state was they didn't have the logistical support to get it to more than, was it two places in each district? So once you make that ruling, do you get to hear later on, do they have to report back to you to say what are the cuts they made in order to make that happen? Because presumably they would have had to reduce other services. You know, is there, do you get to hear back or engage further on that? Or once you make the ruling, is that it?
There's the story of the blue dress that hangs in the Constitutional Court in South Africa. You told that before once. And, you know, that's framed, it hangs there.
So you want to know about it?
Yeah.
I'd be interested in a little comment maybe on one of the rulings where the Constitutional Court mentioned customary law of Indigenous peoples having to amalgamate with and merge with the law of the nation. I think it was the Retchville-Stry case, 2003.
Customary marriages.
Customary law. It was in terms of land ownership and recognition of... it was a restitution, a land restitution case, where the ownership of the land and the minerals was recognised as coming from Indigenous law. And how that's playing out today, that's in 2003, the ruling.
Another one on this side?
Yeah, thank you for your very inspiring talk. I was just interested to go back to Mrs. Brooklyn's, the case you mentioned. How did she access the law in the first place? Was there an NGO? What were the factors? Because in so many cases, poor people, the huge problem is access to the legal system.
I'll start with Mrs. Brooklyn. It was, in some ways, a very lovely case in the sense of a local attorney who was just so indignant, so upset that he volunteered his services. And then he worked with the Community Law Centre at the University of Western Cape. And later on, the Legal Resources Centre got involved. And we find in social economic rights cases, civil society plays particularly important role. Because the poor people don't have the resources, maybe even the knowledge that they can go to court, but that's getting round now, and the stories get out. She became a very famous figure in South Africa. In fact, after the judgment was delivered, everybody had a party. The South Africans love having a party, and you'd think everybody won. And in some ways, everybody did win. So we find that in the health cases, there are bodies, I think that, I'm not sure if it's a Fitz University Law Clinic, might have been involved. There were other NGOs involved. So they bring cases. In the land case, the Rittersveld land case, the Legal Resources Centre worked for 10 years collecting evidence. It makes a huge difference. Certainly in the capital punishment case, it was the Legal Resources Centre. And it's terrific when you're a judge because you get a well-prepared case by people who are very committed, do global international research, do a lot of local research, get factual material, comparative materials. They employ counsel who are really committed and dedicated, and it gives a big lift to litigation generally. So I think for the sort of people in an audience like this, you know, this is people like you going out into your different countries. You might be in government, you might be in NGOs, you might be working for international organizations, who don't take over the campaigns of the poor, but find a mechanism to enable the voice of the poor to be heard in proper legal format in the courts. The case of antiretrovirals, the problems were not an incapacity of government to actually physically distribute the nevirapine from the storage places to the different centres. They said they wanted to find out more about problems with administration in the different centres, problems of breastfeeding, women living with the virus, they take the drug afterwards, and these are real problems. But we said that to wait 2 years until you've collected information on this, while thousands of babies are being born with preventable infections, doesn't stop you from getting that logistical information. But I don't think in that case we ordered government to report back to us. We simply made an order that they were obliged to do it. If they failed to do it, then the applicants could come back to us afterwards. But we do quite often now issue, we call them structural interdicts, requiring a report back. One was, I don't know if you've come across it, Bill, the aftermath to the abolition by the Court of Capital Punishment.
And you issued a statement or a ruling that they complied at some point, right?
Well, yes. It turned out like more than 10 years later, there were people still sitting in prison whose sentences of capital punishment hadn't been substituted yet. It's quite a complicated process involving judges, administration, the president to substitute, and out of 400 odd people who've been sentenced to death, there was something like, I don't know, 60 or 70 who were still waiting to hear. And we ordered the administration to report back to us. They did it once, we ordered it a second time. I think finally after the third, it was like one case outstanding, and we really got them to move on that. So we do it fairly often, and by and large the authorities have been very respectful of orders like this, and we get good information, and again it's another role for the courts. It's a supervisory role. The idea was pioneered in the United States at the time of the school desegregation. When I looked back at the Brown Board of Education case, it didn't resolve the question of unequal education in the United States, but what a blow it was, a positive blow for equality in all sorts of ways. And they invented the idea of the court interdict, reporting back and supervising, with mixed success, but again a different role for the court, not simply to declare what the law is, who's in the right, who's in the wrong, but to manage difficult processes. The Hughes case was referred to that bill maybe before you came. And it's become, when I was trying to raise funds for the integrated artwork in the court and the building was about to go up, I travelled around. We couldn't go to the private sector in South Africa because they might be litigants. They'd love to give money to the court population. They love choosing. Who doesn't? So the only way I could raise extra funds would be from a number of European governments, you know, the Finnish government, the Norwegian, the Dutch, Swedish governments all contributed something, and from foundations in North America. And I told the architects, I said, please, Janina, can't you give me a nice icon of the court that I can use for nice, you know, these things that you dish out to show how stylish you are and that you're really with it. And she said, no, our building is not like that. It doesn't have an icon. It will grow organically. It will emerge. And we wouldn't like the whole building that is an experience that you walk through to be reduced to one particular column or figure or doorway or something like that. The blue dress has become the icon of the court. And maybe because of its very spiritual, non-material character, it serves so well. And Apila Ndwandwe was a guerrilla in Mkhonto with Seesburg, the ANC, military wing of the ANC, whose naked body was found in a shallow grave as a result of the Truth Commission proceedings. The only covering she had was a little bit of blue plastic covering her private parts. And the man who executed her applied for amnesty, and at least he told the story of her last moments so that the family knew how she died. And the family were able to recover her body and give her a dignified burial. So the country gained something. And he had to tell the truth. And he commented, my God, how brave she was. She sang Kosi Sikelel' Afrika, the ANC, and before he pulled the trigger. And the body was found with the bullet wound through the skull and that bit of blue plastic. Judith Mason, the artist, was listening to the proceedings on the radio, and she was deeply moved by the story. And she went out, she bought some plastic bags to sew a dress for, she said, my sister. And she sewed the dress and she wrote very eloquent words on the dress. They sort of painted on the dress. It's hanging in our court now. And it's, sister, the plastic dress may not be the whole armor of God, but you were fighting against wickedness in sordid places. Your weapons were your silence and a piece of rubbish. And what you did is such a commonsensical housewifely thing to do. And yet, in some ways, you shamed your capturers, and they didn't abuse you a second time by stripping you a second time. Memorials for your courage lie everywhere. They blow about in the wind. They're found on thorn trees and on the fences. Hamburgash bin Kwantu. Go carefully, Kwantu. And she painted that dress. Sorry, she did the dress. And then she did a painting with the a predator in the background, a scavenger, sort of a hyena dog, and a wire. And the dress is soaring. It's based on the, she mentions the name there, it's a famous dress in the Louvre.
Yeah, it's double thrust. It's the warrior, what's it called? The winged. Is it the winged warrior or Thamothras? It's written here, I'll just find
it. Right, so based on that, she had the dress, and the Chief Justice's wife, Lorraine Chesterton, said, Albie, you've got to get it for the court. And I went, I saw the picture, I met Judith for the first time. I said, we'd love it for the court, Judith. We haven't got any funds. I've contributed a little bit from my own pocket. And she said, no, she doesn't. It will be an honor for her to have the work there. But I said, the picture is so hard, it's pitiless. And the Truth Commission did get somewhere. And I saw another picture she had of funeral urns relating to four people who'd been electrocuted to death, but glowing, warm. I said, can't you combine the two? And she did the picture, which Bill will show you. It's on the cover.
very small. You
combining the two, and I said, Judith, that's too soft. There's still a lot of pain in our country. She said, take them all. So the three figures now are in the court, and this is not the first book cover to use the picture of the dress. And I was so thrilled when OUP chose it. I didn't ask them to do it. They just felt it embodied so much of the spirit of what I was writing about the way the court does. The last question was about the, I think it was about the, called the Ruchtersfeld case of a community of maybe 10, 20,000, maybe even fewer people who lived right in the north of the Cape Province, now the Northern Province, close to the Namibia border, south of the Orange River, in semi-desert land. And they were claiming restitution. We have a statute that says people who were evicted under racist laws and practices after 1912 are entitled to get their land restored. If the land can't be restored, to get other land or compensation. And tens of thousands of people have benefited, have got land back in that way. Others have got compensation. And this was a group of people who were called nomadic. And the argument was, and what happened, what made the land valuable was diamonds were discovered. And when diamonds were discovered, they were booted off the land. The argument was that they were kicked off the land for gross, crass, commercial reasons. The matter came to us, and we said no. If they'd been whites, they would never have been pushed off the land in the way that they were. They would have got shares in the diamond mines, they would have got all sorts of benefits, number one. And number two, they had rights to the land. The argument was they had no rights to the land. They just grazed their goats, they moved around, they didn't have title to the land. And we said they did have title, equivalent to Aboriginal title, in being litigated on in Australia, in Canada, and elsewhere. The fact that the title wasn't registered with deeds of transfer and the deeds registry office didn't mean they didn't have title. And we had to look to the traditional customary law to see if they had title or not. What saved them was the land was so barren and dusty that the British colonial authorities did a calculation. They said it wasn't even worth surveying the land to bring it under direct crown control and ownership, because the cost of the survey outweighed any benefit they might get from it, and that's what saved them historically. The Legal Resources Centre did 10 years' work, wonderful work, anthropologists, travellers, oral tradition in getting the information.
To what extent ordinary criminal and societal violence in South Africa.
Sorry, can I just say that people have to leave? Do it now, don't feel embarrassed. I'm not encouraging you to go.
Okay. Yeah, to what extent criminal and societal violence in South Africa today relates or is there legacy structures of apartheid?
It's clear that there's a very direct connection in the sense that lives were so disrupted, morality was destroyed, there's massive unemployment, all of these things have been inherited. I think it's important to acknowledge that, but I'm not sure that it's all that helpful. We've got to find solutions, we've got to do it ourselves, we've got to speak and get everybody involved. And the advantage of the benefit of pointing to the past is to show these things are structured, and it overcomes any kind of a notion that there's some races that are more prone to violent behavior than others and so on. I mean, violence can be everybody in South Africa. The whites seized the land violently. They fought each other. They killed each other. Concentration camps. Tens of thousands of Boer women and children died in British concentration camps. The Boers killed Brits. So there was nothing specific to any community in our country about the violence. And one always has to remind people of that. But now we need to engage communities more. We need to strengthen the law enforcement agencies, not by getting police to shoot at random, certainly not to use torture or anything like that, but to improve police intelligence, methodology of work, better relations with communities, community organizations. No one likes the idea, no one says they like the idea of informers. I don't have a problem with informers who are giving information about criminal activity that involves depredations against the communities, local thugs and killers and rapists and so on. I think they are doing an important public service. The only danger comes when people invent stories to collect money for that. So there are lots of ways of dealing with this kind of violence. A form of violence that received a lot of attention recently is violence against women and children. And the law has a very special role to play there. And I did a judgment for the court on the Domestic Violence Act, which appeared to create a tension between human rights and civil rights. When that was put to me in that way, I got quite a shock. What? Civil rights being in conflict with human rights? A civil right should be a right to a fair trial, the right to cross-examine all witnesses, to go to the ends of the earth to get to the truth, as against the right to equality. And it meant cases where it cropped up in Canada and elsewhere, asking a woman who claimed she was raped about her previous sexual experience, and it influenced the jury very much. And so the defendant's rights to a fair trial appear to be in conflict with their right to dignity. I think the two shouldn't be seen as incompatible. They might be in tension. A fair trial means a trial with a fair outcome, and if prejudice against the woman because she fits into a stereotype of a woman who gives up her honor too easily, all that kind of language that was used in a very disproportionate way against women and not against men, if that led to unjust results, that wasn't a fair trial. It wasn't fair to the complainant, to the community. In any event, the Domestic Violence Act allowed for the person accused of breaking a protection order to be hauled without warrant to court and to be questioned, interrogated, which appeared to interfere a bit with the right to silence. But one had to weigh that up against the importance of giving immediate protection to people who have been beaten up and violated. And if you can be graduated, and a person could have legal representation, every kind of defense, could refuse to answer. The result might be that an unanswered challenge, an unanswered complaint that you have continued to beat up your wife might mean that you go to jail if you refuse to answer, but that's a choice that you could make. And I spoke about the importance of balancing out the two. But what was so important was to acknowledge that the law enforcement authorities themselves didn't take domestic violence seriously. There were mainly men in charge. And they would say, speak to your husband, sort it out, this has nothing to do with the law. And the net result is people being killed, people being taken to hospital with broken bones. So the equality dimension came in two ways, domestic violence being this visible form of subordination based on gender through the physical terrorization. And what does that mean to somebody? Not just being beaten up, but living your life in fear. You can't go to sleep, you can't walk in the streets, you're living in dread. What does it do to the humanity of people? And the gender inequality in the structures of law enforcement. So all that was brought out in the course of the judgment, and I thought I was going as far as I could. The colleagues got me to make it even more hard-hitting. It was a very fulfilling judgment for me to write. So we and the courts have to deal with questions like this. We have to deal with the question of making it much more difficult for people to get bail. What was happening was some magistrate was saying, you want your constitution, we'll give you your constitution, just letting everybody out on bail as a right of based on the presumption of innocence. Local communities were horrified, sometimes at great risk to themselves. They would apprehend a killer, a child rapist, hand the person over to the police, and a few hours later the person is out on bail and strutting and terrorizing witnesses not coming forward. So Parliament made it much more difficult in those circumstances for bail to be granted and required more investigation by the magistrates. We upheld the constitutionality of that, provided at the end of the day justice was done on a case-by-case basis. So the questions of how to respond to violence come to the court in different ways at different times. When it came to the rights of the child, people were saying that minimum sentences now being applied to adults could be applied to children as well, and we struck that down because the rights of the child, which are quite strong in our constitution, say that imprisonment must be a last resort. You don't start with a minimum sentence and then look for possible ways of escaping it. You start with the assumption that the child won't be imprisoned. That's children under 18. So we're doing this kind of balancing all the time. Question of Palestine and Israel. I had a rather extraordinary experience in the year 2000. I was invited by the Kennedy School of Government to take part in a workshop on the rule of law in Gaza. And I accepted. It meant landing in Tel Aviv, driving through, going down to Gaza, and it was a very lively workshop with some human rights people saying that they'd been imprisoned by the Israelis and now they'd been imprisoned by the Palestinians as well from human rights groups. Others saying if that happened, if the Israelis imprisoned you, it's because you were fighting for justice. If the Palestinians imprisoned you, it's because you were doing something wrong. They were very sort of loyal to the government, but very lively spirited debates. And I spoke very strongly about how Nelson Mandela had accepted rulings by the court that struck down important proclamations that he'd made. Just saying that we were fighting not simply for statehood, but for dignity in statehood and rights in the new state. I get the invitation when the conference is over to go to Ramallah to meet Yasser Arafat. And I went upstairs in that famous compound, and there was that long table, and there was Yasser Arafat, looking just like Yasser Arafat. The scarf and stubble. He comes up to me and he says, "This man is a hero," and he kisses me on both cheeks. It's quite remarkable, this white Jew from South Africa being embraced with great generosity. The next morning, I'm in Jerusalem, sitting on the Jerusalem Supreme Court bench next to Chief Justice Barak. And again, I feel, you know, this is extraordinary, but maybe we South Africans have a special role to play. And I didn't hide from either where I was going to be and who I was in contact with. And the indirect way in which it answers your question is by not answering your question, is to say that if I have any role to play in that area, it will be to mediate, to be available to both sides. And one consequence is I don't take public stands on issues that could be seen as supporting one side or the other. Sometimes I'm dying to, you know, to speak out, but and Ronnie Casuals is a very close good friend of mine. I think he was a bit alarmed when the Jewish Board of Deputies gave me the Human Rights Award about 2 months ago. I'm not active in the Jewish community, but I don't turn my back on the Jewish community. I am a Jew, it's part of who I am, it's part of my cultural background, but I fight for human rights wherever I am and in the way that I can. My colleague Richard Goldstone has been in the news quite a lot. He did nothing more than chair a commission wanting to hear from both sides, and I think it's extremely important what he's done. I understand families are dividing and arguing whether to take him seriously or not. Is he a traitor to Judaism? It's a very rigorous, sometimes extremely unpleasant debate, but I think his role has been exceptionally important. I don't want to say I want to do exactly what he's doing. He comes from a Zionist background, but I don't. So that's really to placate myself and not answer your question.